welcome to Sheep Stuff You Should Know. I'm Dan Bacon in California, and I'm joined today by somebody clear on the other side of the planet, David McCracken from Scotland's Rural University. And I'm really excited, David, to talk to you about all the stuff you're doing over there. I think it's remarkable to kind of compare production systems in different parts of the world, and you're doing some really interesting stuff. So welcome. Thank you for joining us today.
I'm very happy to be here, Dan, and hopefully the conversation will be of interest to you and your listeners.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So tell me a little bit about Scotland's Rural University. Where is it located, and how long have you been there, and kind of what's your role there?
So we are actually still only Scotland's Rural College. We are going for university status.
Okay.
We're in the process of going through university status applications as we speak. But we're a college that is over 100 years old. We are now an amalgamation of a range of colleges. There was regional colleges and three main regional agricultural colleges up until 2012. And then we joined, so I think there's about seven different colleges have been amalgamated over the years to form one big Scotland Rural College. We're unusual in that, as well as having an academic, both a research and an education and training remit, we also have a consulting remit as well. So we have seven campuses across Scotland currently. We have 25 or 26 local extension offices across Scotland and Northern England, and veterinary services is an important part of what we do as well. So I think we've got now three in veterinary investigation units. So large organisation spread across Scotland and the islands, and all we changed from being the Scottish Agricultural College to Scotland's Rural College to reflect that while agriculture is still an important part of what we do, we also do a wide range of other sort of courses and extension work. So within the department that I head up, which has our Hill and Mountain Research Centre, where I'm speaking from today, and I'll say more about that later on. I also have within my wider department, I have wildlife and conservation management, forestry, education and training, land-based engineering, education and training, and increasingly agricultural technology, both degree and higher national diploma type of courses. Myself, I'm getting a bit old in the tooth now, but I was born and bred on a hill sheep farm, sort of a mountainous farm in southern Scotland. My father was a shepherd for a larger estate, so it wasn't our farm. My dad was employed, he was the head shepherd.
Yeah.
And so born and bred on a hill sheep farm, southern Scotland. Went to university. I did an agricultural zoology degree because I was interested in the link between agriculture and wider zoology, particularly pests and parasites of crops and animals. That was the particular focus of that course. Did a conservation, nature conservation oriented PhD, a rare type of bird on one of our Hebridean islands, the island of Islay, which feeds a lot on insects associated with livestock systems on the island, trying to work out how the livestock systems produce the type of foodstuffs that the birds required, and then worked for a large number of years for a UK nature conservation organisation, but looking across wider Europe and looking at the type of farming systems we have in Europe, where the type of practices that are in place actually help produce a wide range of the nature conservation value in each of these regions. We now call them high nature value farming systems, but basically they're all predicated on the basis that many of the livestock farming systems, and whether it's the forage resource or the fodder resource, many of them have they're based on species rich grasslands or support a wide range of rarer insects and birds that we've put nature conservation value on. So I was coming from a hill sheep farming background originally and saw wider relevance. Hill sheep farming in Europe is not just about production of the livestock products. There's a wide range of other benefits to society, particularly from a biodiversity and a wildlife perspective, that can arise from some of those systems. So that's the sort of journey that I have come on over the last 35 plus years, 27 of which I've been with Scotland Rural College in its various guises.
Oh, okay. I want to come back to that high nature value farming because I'm fascinated by a landscape that's had agriculture for thousands of years as opposed to what we think of agriculture in North America. It's a very different time scale. Definitely want to come back to that. So, you know, most of our listeners are sheep producers, and you can't talk to a sheep person here without them asking about what the grass is like there and what the weather's like. And so where exactly in Scotland are you sitting at the moment, and what are things like there now?
So our research and demonstration farm is in the Southern Highlands. So it's within what's called the Loch Lomond and the Trossachs National Park. So it's basically about a 1 hour's drive north of Glasgow, if people have some concept of Scottish geography. I'm sitting in a hot desk, or a desk I use, but others use it when I'm not there. I'm not based at the site. Every day. I have staff all over Scotland. I'm sitting at a hot desk above our main meeting room, next to a skylight where I can stand up and look out the skylight, and I can see the mountains that form the main part of our foraging resource out there. As well as some of the other mountains that are surrounding us. We're in a bowl. If you imagine us being the offices in the bottom of the valley. But also, I'm looking out on ruins of a 13th century monastery priory, and next to it is a small graveyard that has three graves in it, a whole host of graves in it, but three graves from the 7th and 8th century AD, so early Christian graves. And we use the priory just as an example of the monks in the 13th century through until the Reformation in the 16th century. They would have been managing the land differently than what we are managing the land, but their management of the land would still have been based around a livestock farming system, because the nature of the grazing resource dictates that it's not good for growing crops. So we are you asked about the sort of the our grazing resource. We're 2,200 hectares in size. We are typical of a farm of this type in the Highlands of Scotland, in that we only have a small proportion of what we would call good quality and field-based grassland, primarily ryegrass-based grassland, where we can get it to establish and maintain. We only have about 70 hectares of that.
Okay.
We have another 170 hectares of what we call semi-improved grassland. It was previously rangeland type vegetation, but when the college took over the farms 50 odd years ago, it was still at a low enough altitude that we could try and improve the grazing resource by putting on lime to bring up the pH of the soil, by intensifying the grazing management, and where we could get access, putting on some inorganic fertilizers to try and improve the grazing resource. We did that in the late 1960s and through the 70s and 80s, because we were operating a very high input, high output livestock system at that point in time. In the late 80s, early 90s, the bottom fell out of the sort of the sheep market in particular in the UK. And so it wasn't viable to do that high input, high output system anymore. We think of the farm, or I think of the farm, in terms of what comes over the bridge, because you have to come over a river to get into the farm. And my what comes over the bridge is a euphemism for whatever we need to buy. So if we need hay or straw or concentrated feed, it has to come over the bridge. It comes into the farm at a cost. And in the 90s, we moved away from that high input, high cost, but high output system to a low input, low output system. One that reflected that the vast majority of our grazing resource, you know, the nearly 2,000 remaining 2,000 hectares, is mountainous rangeland type vegetation. Mm-hmm. We're not as high as you can get in your part of the world in terms of the size of the mountains. You know, the highest mountain on our farm is just over 1,000 meters, just over 3,000 feet.
Yeah.
But that is high for our latitude in the UK and in the world. You know, that does bring with it quite a range of and not just topographical challenges, but climatic challenges as well.
Yeah,
we get between, on the lower part of the farm, 2.5 and 3.5 meters of rain per year. On the higher part of the farm, it's probably more like 4 to 4.5 meters of rain per year, which is it's an extraordinarily wet environment. Most of that mountainous, that rangeland grazing resource, it's grassland-based. It's a type of grassland called Nardis grassland, mat grassland. It itself is not a good grazing resource for the livestock, particularly sheep. Got a lot of silicate in it. They try to avoid it. They prefer to eat the finer grasses and herbs that actually grow in that environment during the spring, summer, and autumn. But during the winter period, it's not a great grazing resource for them. So it's quite challenging. So it's not very productive from a livestock productivity perspective. But it can be of interest from a nature conservation perspective, some of the vegetation types that we actually have on the farm itself.
What? Go ahead.
Sorry,
go ahead.
Dan. No, on you go, Dan.
I was going to say, what kinds of wildlife are in the highlands there that are part of that biological diversity? What kinds of things do you see up there?
So, large mammals, we're limited to foxes and badgers. There's nothing larger than a badger. Well, I suppose there's wild boar were lost in Scotland way back in the 17th or 18th century at least. But there's been a lot of releases and or escapes of feral pigs. So there's areas of the country of feral pigs. So that is the largest, together with red deer. Those are sort of the largest mammals we have. We don't have any feral pigs on the farm as yet, but they're not that far from us. So they're another hour's drive north from where we are. You get to an area called Fort William. There's quite a lot of issues with those feral pigs up there. Red deer is a major issue for ourselves. We don't farm the deer. We don't hunt the deer for hunting or for economic gain. But we're surrounded by a number of large estates, large areas of land where hunting of the red deer is their main income source. So we get a number of deer, particularly young stags, passing through the farm every year. If they're out in the main rangeland area, that doesn't bother us. But we have a range of woodlands that we planted over the last nearly 300 hectares that we've planted over the last 20 odd years. If they get into the woodlands, or they get into our low ground, better grassland, then they're competing with us for a grazing resource. So
yeah,
it's basically a pest control policy we have, and the contractor who comes in for us, he will take around about 45 to 50 deer out per year. As if he's got a license that he can hunt them throughout the year if needed. So those are the main mammals. We have a range of large predatory bird species. So golden eagle, we regularly see golden eagle hunting over the farm. And up until recently in Scotland, golden eagle was one of the largest predatory birds that we actually have. But there's a bird that was lost from Scotland in the late 1800s, early 1900s, called the white-tailed sea eagle.
Okay.
They're probably double the size of a golden eagle. If not treble the size of a golden eagle. They were reintroduced into Scotland from the 1970s. They have been very successful at spreading, and we're starting to see immature sea eagles flying over the farm on a regular basis. None nesting close to us as yet, but they are proving an issue with hill farmers further north and west of it, in terms of, particularly at this time of the year as we enter into the sort of lambing season,
right.
They will take live lambs, and you know, so there are issues with predation by white-tailed sea eagles on livestock, particularly younger lambs, over the next couple of months.
We see similar issues here with eagles and bald eagles too.
Yeah, and then we have a wider range of bird species. There's a relatively rare bird now in Scotland called the black grouse. So it lives and nests in young woodland, but they do their lek at this time of the year. The males assemble at this time of year in an area of open hillside. Yeah. To try and attract females. We've managed to get them back onto the farm, still only in numbers of two or three, but better than zero than 10 years ago. And then a wider range of upland bird species, particularly wading birds such as snipe, oyster catcher, and then during the summer, and it's not the summer yet, we will get swallows and house martins and swifts back on the farm, feeding over particularly our water margins and our inbound flows.
Yeah. You talked about the high nature value farming. Are there schemes in Scotland for sheep farmers to kind of be paid for providing that kind of habitat? Is there value to that in terms of a business model?
Yep. So you may or may not know that, I'll say European, because we're still European, even though we're not within the European Union anymore. But the European Union and the UK still, we have a support scheme, a subsidy scheme for farmers. And any of mounted farmers, hill farmers, the type of farmers in the environment that we represent, which is round about 70% of Scotland land area, the vast majority of those farms are not economically viable purely on the agricultural production and process itself. Even with the production support, a farm like us, our size, may be making a profit, a surplus of maybe between £5,000 and £10,000 per year, and that's without taking into account, you know, if we were a normal farm, that farmer's family wouldn't be taking into account their own wages taking out of that. And if you take the subsidy out, then we'll be generally making a loss of somewhere between £5,000 and £10,000 at least every year. But as well as since the 1980s, as well as direct support, which still exists in Scotland, there has also been since the 1980s a separate, what's called an agri-environment scheme, an opportunity for farmers and land managers to undertake to do certain and more wildlife or biodiversity oriented actions on their farm and get some form of sort of payment for that. So we have, we're currently with an agri-environment scheme just coming to an end. So we have a moorland management plan that dictates how many of our sheep and cattle should be in different parts of our rangeland at different times of the year. And also, over the course of the last 6 years, we have created a number of wetland areas on the farm specifically for wading birds, like lapwing or curlew, which are birds that, when I was growing up, were ubiquitous on our farm in southwest Scotland. But curlew have declined by 70% in Scotland over the last 20 years, and lapwing by nearly 60%. So there are payment schemes available to encourage, facilitate farmers to do actions on the ground, but there is a need to do more, or for farmers to do more and farmers to be recognised to do more. We've still not got to a stage where we're recognising and rewarding these additional benefits as well as we need to going forward.
One of the things I read on some of the information that you'd sent me was kind of this challenge about attracting new people to farming and to sheep farming in particular. And that's, in the U.S. and in California, I just turned 55 and I'm still a relatively young sheep producer.
Yeah.
And I suspect there's kind of similar challenges there. What kinds of things are you doing to attract new people into farming?
Yes. So, I mean, you're correct. As I said, we're 2,200 hectares. We're a research farm. So we have I have a research team, but if you put them to one side, we have a farm manager and two shepherds on the farm. But if we were a commercial enterprise, there would be one individual on the farm running that sort of that scale, simply because the low productivity coming from these farms, it's a challenge. It's a challenge to actually make enough money to pay someone else to help you. But it's also increasingly a challenge to find somebody else with the skill sets and who are willing and able to come into this sort of more challenging environment to sort of work. There's been quite a lot. There is a lot of rural depopulation, people leaving the rural areas of Scotland and moving to jobs elsewhere, potentially seeking better opportunities elsewhere in the cities or down in England. So it is difficult to make the case or to make the case for continuing livestock farming in the mountains. Particularly when most people think of livestock farming as it's dog and stick, it's hard work, little return, it's poor weather, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So a lot of what we're doing is researching and demonstrating, showing how you can use technology to actually save on labour, but also make potentially give you more information on your farming system and help make the farming system more cost effective and hopefully more economically viable, but also by highlighting some of the technological routes that can be applied in these upland areas. We are looking to try and attract the younger generation who are used to a lot of technology on their mobile phones and their computer games, etc., to say, well, it's not quite like that, but their interests and their skill sets, they can still apply that type of interest to an actual working farm. And hopefully by doing that, we'll see more people, more young people in particular, being willing and able to actually stay and succeed if that's what is their own farm, or seek opportunities to actually get into land management in some sort of in shape or form. We do have a difficulty. I'm not sure how it's like in the United States. We now have a relatively small proportion of our farms are leased or tenanted. It's 20% or less over Scotland as a whole. But when you go into somewhere like the mountains of Scotland, it's a much greater percentage because there's a much larger number of land owners who have thousands and thousands of hectares, who they manage, which they manage in different ways, and because there's an interest in land reform here in Scotland, there's a concern from landowners that Scottish government or others might force them to give up some of their land to the local community, et cetera, et cetera. So a lot of these larger land owners have been taking their own land that would previously have been tenanted back in hand, working it themselves as a risk avoidance strategy. So there's fewer and fewer opportunities for people to break into and farming, particularly upland and livestock farming.
Yeah. Very, very. I think the causes may be different, but very similar challenges here. The cost of, in my part of the world, in the Sierra Nevada, the cost of owning land or buying land is just astronomical compared to the returns from sheep or cattle.
Related to that is exactly the same here. It's not necessarily the high nature value farmland, although part of it is, i.e. it's the biodiversity interest. But our mountains in Scotland, we don't recognise and reward yet land managers for the other benefits, what we call ecosystem services that are coming off of it.
Right.
So a lot of what I am saying over the last few years is, yes, it is yes, livestock production will still be important from the mountains of Scotland, but actually managing something like water and water quantity will be extraordinarily important going forward. As I said, 2.5 to 3 meters of rain fall on us, but they go straight into the river and go on further down into the River Tay. And there's a large number of urban areas that are at increased risk of flooding. So what we and other upland land managers do in Scotland over the next 20 years will have a big influence on how we can actually try and control flood and flood events after extreme rainfall. And we're getting there, but we're not quite there yet and being able to not just we recognise that upland livestock farmers have a role to play in that. We're not putting in place a reward system where they're actually funded financially and rewarded for doing so. And I think if we can also go back to your original question about getting more people into upland farming, I think if we can actually highlight that there's a wider range of outputs,
right,
not just the livestock from many of these upland farms going forward, and that there's a financial viability in managing for sheep and cows and for water quantity, as well as for biodiversity, then that may help attract a greater range of individuals to come forward who are maybe less experienced or interested in purely in the livestock management side of things, but can see how the livestock management can actually help produce the outputs that they might want to actually be more seen as producing. So
that's a very similar kind of approach, except with fire here in our part of the world.
Okay.
There's a huge driver in terms of using livestock as a fire prevention, fire management technique, which I think is attracting. It's interesting. It's attracting some pretty creative folks, which I think is healthy for us in the livestock.
Yes,
business.
No. I mean, I come from a hill sheep farm, as I said at the start of the process, and so I know, and I work with hill sheep farmers. I know that they're very conservative with a small C, and part of what we're doing is trying to show how innovative technologies or different approaches can be relevant in the uplands. But we do need, not SRUC, but the industry does need more people coming in and shaking things up a little and showing, well, actually, just because it's in Scotland, we would say it's been done that way, it's always been done that way. Just because it's always been done that way in the past doesn't mean to say that's the way it needs to be done in the future.
Yeah.
Or that it should be done that way in the future.
Yeah, absolutely.
We need to recognise that we're in the 21st century, and you know, people who are going to be working the land in the 21st century have 21st century aspirations in terms of the quality of life, etc., as well as can use 21st century approaches and technologies to help manage their livestock on their land that bit better.
Along those lines, I know you're doing a lot of work on kind of applying technology that maybe we traditionally haven't used in agriculture to farming systems. What do you mean by precision farming? That's a term that I saw in some of the material you sent me. Kind of, what's the overview of that?
Yeah, so I mean, we use precision farming or even precision livestock farming to reflect that, you know, for at least 10, if not 20 years, that precision farming term has been used a lot in arable farming and dairy farming and horticulture. All those sectors have been very early adopters of using technology in some cases, but it's primarily all about using data, information, getting information that can allow you to actually make a particular management decision, on-farm management decision, better or more appropriately. Or if you've already made a management decision, allows you to then track whether it's having the desired effect or not. And that's common practice. It's it's a no-brainer. It's taken as read in the arable pig poultry dairy industry. That's what they just do. And in the upland areas, partly because some of that data collection comes at a real financial cost,
right.
But more because that's not the way we've done it in the past. We've always done it this way. Or more importantly, yes, it would be helpful to have data that would allow us to make that decision better, but we can't do it. It's going to be too time-consuming or laborious or expensive to actually get it. So what we're calling precision livestock farming, there's a number of things within that bubble that we talk about when people come to the farm and hear about the range of things we're doing. The common feature about all of them is all about getting a bit more information on a particular issue and choosing to act on that information. Mm-hmm. So it can go from as simple things as in our better quality grasslands, actually doing more regular surveys of the soil condition. We do it every 3 years. And knowing what our soil pH is, knowing what our soil nutrient status is, and taking management decisions based on that. We ourselves, up until about 10 years ago, we ourselves were doing much the same as every other hill farmer was doing. Although the in-by grasslands are a small proportion of the farm, they're a vital part of most hill farms because that's where a good grazing resource will actually be produced. But most people were just treating them the same as they'd always treated them, throwing on, 250 grams of inorganic fertilizer every year per hectare, because that's what they've always done. Not actually taking into account, what is the pH? Is that fertilizer going to be actually mobilized, used effectively, sort of thing? So even just paying due attention to the soil in those better parts of the farm, and then even it's a podcast anyway, so it's not a visual. I should have had one, and I could pretend I've had one. But even just, we have an organisation in Scotland, Quality Meat Scotland, who promote livestock farming and livestock products. They developed a simple sword stick 10 years ago that we're trying to encourage many of our farmers in the uplands, in the better quality grassland, to actually use thresholds. If you're getting below a certain threshold at a particular time of year in terms of grass height, get the livestock in, or get the livestock
under rest.
Get the livestock out. Give them that. Grass is a wonderful thing. You can graze it to within an inch of its life, and it will come back. But if you graze it too hard, it will take a lot longer to come back. And you can make a big, huge difference in the amount of grazing you've resourced to have from a relatively small area by actually just measuring it. We started our shepherds doing it about 8 years ago. And I remember a good few months after they started, we said to them, "How are you finding it?" And they said, "Oh, no, it's easy. Yeah, we do just 10 measurements each field. We can do an average. That's fine. We know what it is. We can take a decision." And we actually said, "Well, yeah, that's great. But actually, we were meaning, how are you finding it? What do you mean? Well, actually, say it was today, standing in this field. If you were in this field today and hadn't done those measurements, what would your decision have been?" "Oh, well, by the look of it, we would probably have kept them in for another week." "Yeah, but the sword stick is telling you you need to move them out now." Yeah, we get that. So even that can make a difference.
Yeah.
And then you can go up to the other end of the spectrum where it's actually using technology, a wide range of technology, to give you information that you wouldn't be able to get hold of easily by any other route, to give you an idea of what condition your livestock are in, or give you an idea of what the soil temperatures are like, or whatever it may be. Different types of information sources, data streams, allowing you to make a decision, a more informed decision about something that hopefully, if you get it right, will actually then help lift the overall sort of performance of the farm themselves, the livestock themselves.
One of the I think areas of highest labor demand here, and I would assume it's the same there, is kind of lambing season. But that's when everybody, it's all hands on deck, and it's a pretty intensive time. What kinds of technology are you looking at that addresses some of those labor needs at those particularly intense times, like lambing?
So, I mean, lambing, there's especially when you need to intervene. There's no real technological solutions to being out. Yeah. And being in the right place at the right time, getting your hands dirty and intervening where you can. I suppose it's a technological solution. Actually, if you take one step back, what we've been looking at is assessing the performance of our ewes, our sheep and their lambs regularly, and actually using performance of both the mother and the daughter to select who we actually keep. So we don't start, this is only the 19th of April, mid-April, we won't start lambing for another week or so. But when we do start lambing, then we have one of our flocks, the particular research flock is very intensively monitored. So as well as the shepherds intervening when necessary to actually help with the lambing itself, within that flock, colleagues of my team, the technicians of my team, will be going around the lambing fields, will be catching every lamb within 12 hours of it being born. Mm-hmm. We'll be weighing that lamb, we'll be tagging that lamb, we'll be identifying that lamb from that point on with its mother. Mm-hmm. It's associated with its mother. We've got that in a database. And then we'll track that sort of performance as we go through. And two of the things that we're assessing at that point in time is maternal instinct. I think it's sort of a scale of 1 to 5. And I can't remember which way around it goes. But say the mother scored as a 1, that means that you're holding that lamb and she's still standing right beside you. Mm-hmm. You know, she's interested in that lamb. Yeah. 5 is where she's already two fields away, having just over the fence. The 5, we don't want. We want in our environment, we want good mothers. And also they'll be scoring all of our sheep on the basis of ease of lambing. We want ones that are going to be as few interventions as possible.
Right.
It obviously takes time over years to actually get to that stage, but that is a technological fix to some extent. Yeah, let's actually collect some information and then act upon it. Many farmers do know which sheep have the difficult lambings, and many will even mark them in some sort of shape or form at lambing time. But when it comes to stock dispersal in the autumn, they'll have forgotten all about it. And so there's a good chance that she'll come round, you know, for a second or a third time, and they'll still have the same problems, et cetera, et cetera. So even that, just a notebook and a pen and writing down and remembering to pick it up at the right time, you know, is a bit of sort of technology. A lot of our technology is after lambing. So when we're, well, it's both before and after lambing. So we ultrasound scan our ewes, which is common practice in most lowland sheep flocks in the UK and in Scotland. Data we've got would suggest that still only about 50 or 60% of hill farms will actually ultrasound scan.
Oh, okay.
To know what how many lambs are being carried and then act accordingly. You know, if you've got a ewe bearing 2 or more lambs, then pull them out of the flock and treat them differently. But so at the period of ultrasound scanning, if we start at that point, all our sheep will go through. We've got a weigh crate and an associated auto drafter.
Yeah.
So the weigh crate, you know, weighs our sheep every time they go through, or lambs every time they go through it, whether we want them weighed or not. Store that in the database that we've built up for all the livestock on the farm. And the auto drafter is capable of sending them into one of 5 different pens. So pre-scanning, we'll also want to get an idea of the weights of the ewes and whether any have lost more condition than we might like them to, so we can put them into identify them and put them into a separate grouping and then feed them differently. Old school way, you know, you would be going through them and condition scoring them by hand,
right?
Trying to make a judgment on whether, you know, they were in the right condition or not, and looking to pull out ones that you might want to actually feed differently or give some different feed to. That even for 500 sheep, that could probably take 2 of you a whole day to go through and do that properly.
Yeah.
Using the handling system we've got with the weigh crate and auto drafter, we can program we can program the system to say, draw out those sheep that are 5 kilos, say, less than what they were when they were in before Christmas, something like that, you know?
Yeah.
And we can put 500 sheep through in 1 hour. And at the end of 1 hour, we have a pen that has animals in it that are, the system is suggesting there's a problem somehow with these. And we then have the choice to intervene. And, we have the ability to say, right, what is the issue with these sheep? What can we do about it to try and improve things? Because the difficulty is in the Highlands of Scotland, because it can take 3 or 4 days to actually gather in all your sheep off the mountains, many hill farmers don't have the facility or the time to go through their animals individually.
Right.
So when the animals come in, wherever they're coming in for, they're all treated the same. They're treated as a flock. Right. Everything is treated the same and put back out. And that type of handling kit technology that we were testing originally for 5 years and now we advocate as it's just best practice for us, we are showing how that can be used to manage a flock as a group of individuals, identify individual needs and manage according to those individual needs, separate out those that need a bit of extra feeding in the run-up to lambing, there we go, we've got them here, separate out those that, you know, may actually need to be removed from the flock at some point.
Right.
We can't always have, you know, with the best one in the world, improving sheep performance is not about improving the performance of every single sheep. In many cases, it's about identifying which are the underperforming ones that are going to continue to underperform and actually select them out of the flock, call them out of the flock. So that's a major part of the technology that we're actually using. And then in a wider sense, most of our sheep spend most of the time out on the rangeland, out on the open grazings, and they are open in the fullest sense. Although we have fences on the lower part of the field, most of our mountain grazing resource is unfenced because it's high enough up that the snowfall every year would destroy the fences, etc. So it's just open to our neighbours. And as livestock production in the mountains of Scotland has decreased over the last 10, 15 years, many of our neighbours are no longer farming. And so there's more scope for our livestock to go further and further away from us. So we've been trying to identify, or we've not been trying, we did work with a private company to identify a tracking collar, that could not only track the sheep and let us know where they were, but also had a number of accelerometers in it that would actually tell us, give us some indication as to what the animal was doing. Was it lying down? Was it lying on its side? Was it standing up? Whatever. With a view to trying to use that information to give us an indication, well, she seems to be lying down an awful lot. Maybe there's something wrong with her. Shall we find out where she is and go and intervene? And that technology does work. The difficulty with sheep farming is getting that kit down to a price. When you can get it down to a price that's £100 per unit, but the sheep's worth £50 per sheep, that doesn't stack up.
Not going to pencil.
So what my colleagues were involved in a range of European projects at the moment, two of which we're leading on, which are looking focused specifically at technology. What we're looking at is, well, what is it you need to actually know, and is it feasible to get that information easier, cheaper? So rather than put the super duper, one example, rather than put the super duper kit on every single animal, if we're interested in when we're feeding hay to our animals out on the rangeland, who is coming to that hay more regularly?
Oh yeah.
Who's choosing not to come to that hay at all?
Yeah.
And are the ones that are choosing not to come to the hay still performing fine? Because if they're still performing fine, then they don't need the hay.
Yeah.
And the hay, if you remember, is something that comes over the bridge. It comes at a cost to us, etc.
Yeah.
So what they're looking at is the more expensive bit of kit. I think it's, I can't remember because I don't sign checks anymore. I press buttons to approve things, but I can't remember whether it was £150 or £200. But that bit of kit, you know, is attached to where the hay is put in the rack out in the hill, and basically the sheep they're trialing, they all just have a Bluetooth receiver around their neck. And every time they come close to that beep, it records who's there and how long they're there for.
Yeah.
And then you get, in the graphs I've seen, you get this diurnal movement where there's nobody taking it at night, obviously. Then during the day, you get more and more sheep around the hay, and then it peaks, and then it tails off. But we can dig into that data and see who should be out, who's out there, who's coming to the field, the feed very often, and so why should that be? Who's not coming to the feed very often? And does that mean that they're more adapted to being out on that hill at this time of year? And if that's the case, well, why don't we actually, as well as our other selection criteria, why don't we add in the fact that, you know, you don't need all the supplementary feeding that we're giving you. Let's see if we can actually focus more of our attention on selecting from those animals as well. Just one example of just trying to actually get a better handle on things. Other things, you know, I'm unclear what your own sheep systems are like, but these extensive grazing systems, then you know you've got sheep out there, you know they're pregnant, you know they've lambed, but when you're gathering everything in, then you've absolutely no idea whose lamb is with who, right, which mother. So we have a second flock on the farm that is a typical high hill, high mountain flock. It's up there, the individuals are up there 24/7, you know, 365 days a year. And so it's less easy for us to know who is producing the better performing lambs and vice versa.
Yeah.
So to date, I've been wincing every time I press a button, but we've been using all our sheep in that flock. We know the DNA profile, and we know the DNA profile of the rams that went out in November. Mm-hmm. So when our lambs come in after lambing, when we're tagging them, we'll use that skin tag. We send these skin tags off to a company in New Zealand, and they come back. They'll send us back an indication of, you know, lamb A, there's a high probability its mother is X and its father was Y.
Right.
And we can then use that to allow us to then track that lamb through the rest of its time on the farm and say, well, is that something a lamb we would actually want to maintain or not? Going forward, and we can then try and work back. Well, maybe we should retain that mother or that sire or whatever. So, those are also things that we're actually doing. That does come at a cost, and it can be quite costly. So, what they're also doing at the moment is, can you get that same information on who is mother and lamb again by having collect data on who is an individual sheep interacting with most often.
Yeah.
And is the lamb that they interact with most often, does that have a high likelihood to be their own lamb?
Offspring, yeah.
Again, using some simple and much cheaper technology on the ewe and on the lamb to get that level of information. We've got a PhD student who's been got a number of PhD students, but that PhD student is looking into that aspect as well. Again, using technology, we're a research group, but we can't research things that are going to be out with the ability of anybody else to afford. So we're looking to use technology that we think, if it works, does it work, and does it work reliably? Is it at a price that anybody else could choose to actually utilize that same sort of approach? Because that's where that's only going to be how we can really make a difference, if we can actually show the art of the possible in an affordable way and what the benefits are coming out of that.
That's a very similar consideration in our large Western range flocks, you know, trying to find cost-effective ways to gather that data that can then actually be acted on and improve profitability, I think, is a real critical component to it.
And we're not doing it yet, but as I said, we get a lot of information from the Waycrate and the Autodrafter.
Mm-hmm.
But that's in our handling facilities, that's in our shed.
Yeah.
So we need to bring them in, and we only get that information when they're in. Two of the European projects that we're looking at, some of our European partners are interested in how can you operate these sort of way crates in a out in the grazing resource.
Yeah.
What do you need to do to try and encourage the animals to come over them regularly, and how can you then separate out? How accurate are these, the data that's got there, and does that actually help? So we're not doing that at the moment, but I do know from speaking to my colleagues, I'm concerned that is something that they would be keen to look into. Because if all our sheep were in a field and we could gather them in and just run them through the shed, great.
Yeah.
But as I say, 3 or 4 days, depending on the weather situation, 3 or 4 days plus, we probably need 6 different people out on the mountain to actually get a good gather.
Yep.
Extraordinarily laborious and time-consuming. If we can get similar data more easily by having the kit out where the animals are rather than bringing the animals to it, that would be of benefit and use to ourselves as well and others potentially.
And you're doing some work in collaboration with New Mexico State University, right?
Yes.
So they're very different from Scotland. And having been there, it doesn't remind me of Scotland at all.
Yeah, no. Because it doesn't. So it's a few years ago now, a chap, Andrew Siblis, he was a professor of rangeland science at that time.
Yeah.
He happened to be in Scotland for I think it was an animal welfare conference, but asked if he could come and see us just for an afternoon. We're about 2 hours drive from Edinburgh, and he was happy to come up, and I was happy to host him. At that point, he'd been doing some GPS tracking work on livestock in various parts of the globe, and was interested in what GPS work we'd been doing, and we just started to do some of the Internet of Things technology tracking work at the farm itself. So he came and saw us for it was probably a good part of a day, and he was lucky. He came in one of the few days when it wasn't raining, and so he got a good sight of the farm. He could see what we were doing. And long story short, we applied for and were successful second time around, I think it was, some Fulbright funding to allow him to come over. He came over and spent 3 or 4 weeks with us, and worked with myself and others in the wider team. He brought some of his GP tracking devices over, and we were comparing and contrasting them with what we were using, and he took some of ours back into the States. Long story short, he was one of the leads on the Sustainable Southwest Beef Project, that's been funded by the US Department of Agriculture. And as part of that project, we've kept up that link. There's a couple of my colleagues who are in there as sort of specialist advisors on the technology side of things. I would have been and could have been part of that as well, but unfortunately at that particular juncture, I was the head of the research team at the Mountain Centre. But at that particular juncture in my career, I then took on a responsibility for a much wider department as well, within which that is only part of. So that has limited my time to be able to input into that. But no, that's how it physically came about. Going back to your original question about Southwest United States, dry, uplands of Scotland, highlands of Scotland, extraordinarily wet. Yeah, they are completely different in terms of the climatic conditions. But as far as the impact on the livestock is concerned, there's poorer grazing resource. There's extreme weather events extreme weather events.
Yeah.
That impacts very, very similarly on the livestock in terms of their health and their welfare and their condition. And so being able to identify where animals are performing well or performing poorer and being able to intervene earlier is the common factor. So the systems are different, and also they're working on beef systems. We are primarily focusing most of our work on our sheep systems, but nevertheless, the common factor is the technology and using it in a challenging rural sort of environment. Can we get it to work? Does the information that's coming from that technology, is it sufficient to actually give you an early warning, a heads up about a problem started to happen, and can you intervene sort of early enough with it? So, you know, the example I gave about our supplementary hay feeding during the winter.
Right.
They've been doing similar things, but actually measuring not just are animals able to access water tanks, but actually measuring is there water in the water tanks and knowing where they actually have to go and move animals around if the water started to dry up sooner than expected, and a basic sonic sensor just measuring the depth of water in the tank can very easily give you that type of information without you having to drive for 40 minutes or whatever it is out to a particular tank just to check that everything's fine, they're sufficient in there for the number of animals around there. So yeah, that's the point of contact there is the technology, what it can tell you about how the environment and the weather in that environment is impacting on the performance of your livestock.
And I would suspect that kind of the distance from so-called civilization and kind of these rural, very remote environments present similar challenges, whether you're in the mountains of Scotland or the mountains of the Southwest.
Yeah, no, indeed. Most of the technology as existed, you know, is reliant on you've got your technology. You can plug it into an existing power supply, i.e. a mains power supply, and it'll work fine. Well, in the Highlands of Scotland and Southwest United States, that's not possible. There is no mains supply. So part of the challenge is how do you actually get the technology to actually work? What length of battery life can you get out of some of these sensors if you need to actually change the battery every 3 weeks? Then
it's not going to happen.
It's not going to happen. So some of these sensors that were, and it depends then what level of data points you actually set. Right. Most of our sensors that we have are set automatically to give information every 10 minutes.
Okay.
If we were doing it more regularly than that, the battery life would be less. If we're doing it more and less regularly than that, the battery life would be longer. But we're talking about battery lives of 3, 4, 5 years at least, if not more. And once one bit of kit put out in the environment, robust enough to be in the environment, then it will operate and send data as long as you can capture that data and pull it down out of the ether, which is part of what we're doing and part of what the Sustainable Southwest Beef focuses. What is the type of data you can get, but just as importantly, how can you get the data and the technology to actually work in these extreme environments? And how do you interpret that to best effect for the system you're looking at?
I'm absolutely fascinated by all of that. I think there's some real similar parallels here in our part of the Sierra Nevada. We're doing a little bit of work on kind of predator and sheep interactions in areas that are very remote. And I think we've got a lot to learn from the technology that you're starting to use there and that they're using in New Mexico in that regard.
Yes. No. I mean, it's some of this stuff is so new and so innovative. It's difficult to get your head around what are the questions, you know,
right.
in the technology sphere. It's what is the use case? What do you want to know and how do you want to get the data and what we could do about it? And I know myself, when we started work at the farms here in Scotland, I asked a wide range of colleagues, not just within my organisation, but externally. Forget how you get hold of the data. Just park that. What type of data might be actually helpful for you? And I must admit, I was extraordinarily disappointed with nobody was thinking outside the box. The thing about this technology is, 20 years ago, you might have been able to ask a question and the technology didn't exist.
Right.
Now, you know, it's not quite, there's a technology existing for everything, but things have become so technologically oriented that there are companies out there producing kit that could have multiple uses. They have no idea how you would use it on a Highland farm or on a beef farm in Southwest United States, and nor should you expect them to. But for many of the questions that that we might be asking, what type of data would be helpful to have in our environment? For many of those questions, the solution already exists, and it's just trying to actually marry up who has that tech, how robust it is. In our case, it's because sensors are obviously got circuit boards and electrical components sort of thing. We need to be extraordinarily sealed, you know, waterproofed, otherwise things will very quickly go in the fridge sort of thing. You do have to try and just blank your mind and step back and think, what would be the type of data, the information that would help me make this decision, or what would I use to know whether that's been helpful or not? So Scotland holds 2 million hectares of peatland soils, very organic, deep soils. Mm-hmm. And 80% of those soils are degraded. So they're emitting gases to the atmosphere and contributing to climate change. But conversely, if they're restored, they have the real potential to make very, very quick wins in terms of starting to sequester carbon properly again. So we've done some peatland restoration as part of a wider Scottish Government funded focus on our farms. Our peatlands are relatively shallow, and they occur right up in the top of the mountains, on the ridge of the mountain, so at 500 to 700 metres. So it's very difficult to get detailed information from what's happening in those peatlands up there.
Yeah.
But what we're doing is, well, actually, if those peatlands are actually doing the job we would like them to do, and if the additional woodland that we've planted is doing the job we would like it to do, we would expect that after extreme rainfall events, we have two valleys on the farm, two glens, Highland Glens, two valleys, we would expect that if those environmental changes we've done are making a difference, we would expect the water coming out of one of those glens, one of those valleys, to be slowed. And so we're using a series of river level or water level monitors, all down that catchment, or the catchment as it stands on our farm, just to give us some indication as extreme rainfall event hitting both of those glens. Is the water coming out of the very heavily grazed glen with no peatland restoration and no woodland in it? Is it coming out a lot quicker and flat and more intense than the one in the glen next door? We're not quite answered that question yet, but we're starting to collect data that will allow us to answer that. And we know we're only talking about 60 hectares of peatland restoration and 200 hectares of woodland established 20 odd years ago. That won't be enough to make a difference 100 miles further down the tee. But if we can show it does make a difference at the level of our farm, then we can then start to extrapolate out to say, well, if another half a dozen farms of our scale in this environment did something same collectively, they might have enough of an impact to actually hold back sufficient of the water to either reduce the flooding levels further downstream, or at least give a bit more early warning that flooding is going to happen to those downstream effects.
And I would imagine that could have some, that you'd be able to put some economic numbers to that too. That if you're slowing that water down, you're avoiding problems further downstream too.
Yeah, and that's where many of what I mentioned earlier on, we're recognizing that hill farmers in Scotland and elsewhere have a role to play in many of these wider environmental issues, but we're not rewarding them. And part of the reason we're not rewarding them is there's not that confidence that if you do this, you'll definitely justify a payment for it. And so there's a number of other colleagues, not in my team, although we are working with them, looking at how can you, how robust does this technology need to be? You know, how accurate does the information need to be? How sure can you be that the information is reflecting what's actually happening on the ground? Right. And once we can show that, that's when, you know, probably the private sector as much as the public sector will come on board and say, I want to support that because this is having a benefit further downstream. You know, insurance companies might want to invest in that type of land management, because it then saves them having to pay out so much in insurance claims when there's flood events and further downstream. Or it gives the, in some cases, there are individuals in Scotland who now can't get insurance against flooding because they're in such a high risk flood area. So it's always trying to, how can you reduce the risk to the wider population in Scotland? So
very similar issues here with fire, people not getting insurance for wildfire threat. And I think there's a real opportunity to tie kind of solid grazing management to addressing issues too.
Yes, no, I mean, I'm aware, well, I hope they're still going, but certainly in Andalusia and southeast Spain, oh God, I was going to say a few years ago, probably 10 years ago now, the local authority were paying goat farmers to actually go out and graze the fire breaks.
Yeah.
Because it was much cheaper to do that than go out with heavy machinery every couple of years to clear these breaks. So, you know, it's just stepping out of the box a little bit and just thinking, what else can you use these four-legged things, you know, with teeth that like to actually eat this type of vegetation? What can you use them for that's more than just, you know, producing meat or producing milk sort of thing, or hair or hide or wool? So.
Exactly. Well, Davey, thank you very, very much. We could talk the rest of the evening. I could keep you tied up until it was time for you to go to bed over there, I think.
Yes,
thank you.
I know. As I say, I could talk for Scotland about a wide range of things, and there's a number of things we haven't really touched on, like you know, what we're doing as far as knowledge exchange are concerned, or how we're getting these things out to farmers. But you know, I'm more than happy to have chatted today, and more than happy if you think there's more there, more than happy for you to come back to me at some point.
Love to do that. And,
you know, I'm happy to follow up with things. So that was great. Excellent.
Yeah, would love to follow up. Let's do another one. That'd be great. Thank you. Well, this is Sheep Stuff You Should Know. Dan Makin in California, again joined by David McCracken from Scotland. After evening in Scotland, morning in California, and look forward to talking with you again soon. Thank you.